Good morning, all. In the busiest part of the session, I just wanted to let you know that some of the bills that we're doing this morning are for informational hearings because the bills have not arrived in our committee yet, but they are destined for this committee. So we're going to get our work done, and then we will lay them over for inclusion when they get here. If we could start, I'm going to change the, just because of people getting here at 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to change the order a little bit, and we're going to start with House File 1663, which will be an informational hearing. Representative Moe, thank you for being here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for being here at the start of the committee. The House File 1663, Wildlife Protection Bill, procedurally, this bill has to go to government operations, and those of you here know that that committee is somewhat logjammed right now, so we're scheduled to be heard on Thursday. From government operations, it'll be referred to finance to be re-referred to us, so we will then can take action next week, probably Tuesday, maybe whenever we the chair can squeeze us into our schedule. This is House File 1663 was amended to include House File 1662. These bills are now traveling together. This does three things, and then I'll bring up our testifiers. The first is there has the DNR doing a study in conjunction with stakeholders, including the Department of Agriculture, the affected tribes, other citizens, assessing the threats to our native wild rice, and will report back to us on what they are. And accumulating the current research also on wild rice. The second part of the study looks at, or will ask the Environmental Quality Board to begin rulemaking, commence rulemaking, to require an environmental impact statement should there be an introduction of a genetically modified version or a test plot applied for wild rice within the state of Minnesota, which is essentially the de facto position now. If the federal court has ruled that if such test plots are applied for around the country, that an EIS should be required. And the third part is that the Environmental Quality Board shall notify interested parties, and there'll be a notification process or a list that interested parties can get on if anywhere in the United States a test plot is applied for a genetically modified strain of wild rice. Three levels of protection. We've worked at length with all the stakeholders on this. Well, we got some of them in the fold. The University of Minnesota is no longer opposed. The Farmers Union is supportive. We still have a little division with some interested parties. I don't think we'll ever get through that completely. If we were to do what those interested parties would want us to do, it would be nothing. So. That's not at least a good compromise from my perspective and the people that are interested in some protection for native wild rice. So with that, I'll bring up Andrea Hanks from the White Earth Land Recovery Project. We'll give some testimony first.
Madam Chair, we should just vote right now.
We can't vote on this one because we do not have the bill before us. This is an informational hearing.
Trying to help.
As soon as we can vote, I promise you we will. In the meantime, have a cup of coffee and it will be better.
Good morning, committee members. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Andrea Hanks, and I'm the Wild Rice Campaign Coordinator with the White Earth Land Recovery Project. I recently started this position in August and picked it up quickly. Today I speak as a member of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. I represent myself as an Anishinaabe person. I did not have the luxury of growing up here in Minnesota. I grew up in New Mexico. But my family traveled back every year and to visit our family at White Earth. And so I'm familiar to wild rice. My identity is directly tied to it. Growing up in New Mexico, my father always had wild rice sent to us in September. during harvesting season. So as far as way of New Mexico, I, as an Ojibwe person, can value and appreciate wild rice. Unfortunately, I didn't get the luxury of ricing every year, but I did go out this September and rice, and I will continue to do so. I sit here today and I testify because I would like my children someday to be able to go out on those lakes and rice, as my father and my grandfather and my great-grandfather did. Today I sit here and visit with my uncle in the city while I'm down here working this campaign, and he often shares stories of ricing with my father as they were kids growing up. There's 11 kids in my father's family, and wild ricing was a direct impact on the economy of his family and their income. It provided, you know, as many of you guys have heard probably previously in the first committee, was it does provide income during the winter for families, and it provides, you know, luxuries that otherwise would not be afforded, such as school clothes, and this is something that is true with any family who rices. It stands true in my family today, as I have extended family cousins that grew up ricing. If you go to wider, you'll usually find either a Hank or Bellinger ricing on those lakes up there. So along with that, we have ceremonies that are going to include wild rice, and those ceremonies include from the beginning of life till the end of life. And this summer I will also get to take part in the ceremony that will include wild rice that my family will be conducting this summer in honor of our two youth in our family. They'll be giving the naming ceremony done, and this is through wild rice. So as you know, wild rice is directly tied to us as a people from the beginning of life to the end of life. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? I don't see any questions. Thank you for coming.
Good morning.
My name
is Alan Richardson. My name is Alan Richardson. I'm the outreach coordinator for the campaign to protect wild rice from contamination by engineered genes. Madam Chair, representatives, there's broad support for the legislation before you today. Since last year's legislative session, numerous businesses, public interest groups, local governments, mayors, city councils have joined this campaign. That we now have the support of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, for example, means that Minnesotans from many faiths recognize this issue as one of religious and spiritual dignity. The standard argument used by opponents of our legislation is that anything which restricts biotechnology sends a chilling message to the research dollars, implying that biotechnology interests would reduce their investment in the state if wild rice were protected from the threat of contamination by engineered genes. They also contend that protecting wild rice would somehow affect genetically engineered crops that are already widely used, such as corn or soy, or would prevent the genetic engineering of crops that certain agricultural interests would like to see engineered, such as wheat. In June of last year, the University of Hawaii chose to honor the wishes of Native Hawaiians by agreeing not to patent or genetically engineer taro, a food source sacred and essential to Native Hawaiians as wild rice is to the Ojibwe. This clearly establishes in academic terms that plants and crops, which are traditional forms of spiritual and economic sustenance for Native people, are in a unique and distinct category. A 10-year moratorium on the patenting and genetic engineering of taro has since passed the Hawaiian State Senate. Neither of these decisions to protect taro have had any negative impact on Hawaii's economy, and Hawaii's biotech sector remains one of the most robust in the nation. On the other hand, contamination that occurs when experimental, unregulated engineered genes escape their test plots does have a negative economic impact, such as the ongoing financial catastrophe afflicting the white rice industry. Here in Minnesota, we are seeking protection for wild rice, our state grain, the only food protected by treaty on the entire continent. The crux of our issue is that wild rice is unique and distinct, therefore it would be literally impossible for our legislation to be used as a precedent regarding the genetic engineering of domestic crops. We are gratified that the University of Minnesota has declared themselves neutral to this year's legislation. Their insistence that academic freedom gives them the right to conduct open-air tests of genetically engineered wild rice is central to this entire debate. It is crucial for legislators to recognize that the scientific community now concedes that it is technologically impossible to contain open-air trials of experimental genetic engineering. And as demonstrated by the three recent federal court rulings concerning genetic engineering, no advocate of biotechnology has the luxury of denying that there are environmental effects associated with the technology. We believe this year's legislation represents a compromise we can all live with, and we urge your support for it. Thank you.
Are there questions from the members?
Members of the committee, if anybody has specific questions also to the other examples, court cases, anything like that, in regards to genetically engineered crops or wild rice in general, Alan is the resource for that, so that'll be a good time for those questions.
I don't see any questions. I think folks
have heard a good bit about this.
They've heard a good bit about this. Now, here is Representative Hoppe. He's going to help us out here.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'm going to help us out. I like this bill. I think it's a good idea. And I'm just a procedural question. Is this coming before us?
Yes.
Okay.
It is coming before us. It has not arrived yet.
Okay, good.
And so when it comes here, we will take action to lay it over. But we can't do that this morning.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We will see this again next week, hopefully.
I'm hoping it's before next week. Thank you very much. I think the next bill, if we could do it, we are jumping around a little bit this morning just because of witnesses coming. Representative Scalzi, could we do House File 2216? Again, we will be having an informational hearing. And again, it's because the bill has not arrived here yet. Yes, Representative Hansen will be moving the minutes of March 15th. Any questions, members? All those in favor say of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bev Scalzi, member of this committee, and we have before us today a House File 2216, which also has a Senate companion. Senator Chaudhary is carrying the Senate companion. This is regarding watercraft license fees, and it affects aquatic invasive species prevention and control. And with us today, we have representatives from Minnesota Waters, and many of you know that this is a new group that was formed from the previous Minnesota Lakes Association and the Rivers Council of Minnesota. So first of all, we'll start out with Mr. Dick Osgood. He's with the Minnesota Waters Aquatic and Species Task Force.
Thank you. Also with me today are my friends Eric Lindberg and Terry Christian. We're here as volunteers. I do have a slideshow that's being queued up, so while that's happening, I will say that we're representing Minnesota Waters as volunteers. I am on their executive committee and chair their public policy committee. And we're here in support of House File 2216, as Representative Scalzi just mentioned. Just a little bit of background. As I said, I'm here as a volunteer, as are my colleagues on my right and left. I am, by training and education, an aquatic ecologist and scientist and lake manager. I work as a consultant. I wear other hats as well. Specifically, one of my jobs is executive director of the Lake Minnetonka Association, and in that capacity, I'm familiar with a number of aquatic invasive species. I'm also president-elect of the North American Lake Management Society, an international organization. We're here today, and I'm starting in some of my slides, which when I get there, we'll skip through. We're here today in support of the governor's budget proposal with regard to aquatic invasive species, and we're here through the House File bill I just mentioned to upgrade and beef it up just a little bit. Thank you. That said, aquatic invasive species, AIS, are harming our lakes and rivers. I was in a committee meeting yesterday and heard that our friends at Green Lake and Spicer have been advised by some field agents that Eurasian water milfoil may actually be a good thing for lakes. I personally, in Minnesota Water's position, is that is not the fact, but not the case at all. Aquatic invasive species harm lakes and rivers. Period. They just do. Some do more harm than others, of course, but there's nothing really good about them. The number of our infested waters are increasing. The number of exotic species, the nasty plants and animals are increasing. Our reliance on voluntary compliance and enforcement to stem the spread of these is not adequate, and our investments in control and prevention are not adequate. That's why we're gratified that the governor's proposed budget increases what the baseline, but we think the increase in the need is much larger. As a result, I cite the fact that Eurasian water milfoil is added to about 10 new lakes per year, and this is too many. Compared to Wisconsin, for example, Wisconsin had, in their early infestation, 2 lakes per year. So 10 lakes per year is, of course, much greater than that, and that's troubling on its face. But what's more troubling, and is the nature of these invasions, is that at some point they take off. We see here in Wisconsin, after about 30 years, went from 2 lakes per year to 40 to 50 lakes per year all of a sudden. And that's likely to happen in Minnesota as well, unless we change the game. So we now have 190 water bodies with Eurasian water milfoil, and before long that could be much greater. The other is we're not doing enough to prevent the spread. For example, zebra mussels were discovered in Mille Lacs Lake a couple of years ago, and the inspections of watercraft leaving that lake have been increased to only about 3% of those leaving that lake each year. There are about 500,000 boats and trailers that come and go to Lake Mille Lacs each season. This is, again, this is inadequate. As an example, I was speaking to the Indiana Lake Management Society last month. They found hydrilla, a plant we do not yet have in Minnesota, in one lake, and they shut it down. Even lake residents have to jump through hoops to get their boats and trailers into that lake. And then if they leave in the during the season, they can't come back in. They're taking it that seriously. So aquatic invasive species do harm fish, habitat, and water quality. And for some, like zebra mussels, once they're in a lake or a river, there is no remedy. Nothing. They're there to stay. So prevention makes sense. And in fact, it's the only thing that makes sense. The money in the DNR's budget ought to be augmented. Minnesota Waters is recommending an increase of the boat license surcharge from $5, its current level, to $25, and we estimate this will raise an additional $3 million over and above the governor's budget request. This increase is large. It certainly is, but we think it's small compared to the need. It's fair and proportional. The aquatic invasive species are moved predominantly by boats and trailers. Just as another comparison with Indiana, the state of Indiana is spending more on a single lake, Lake Manitow, to control hydrilla than the current state of Minnesota's aquatic invasive species budget statewide. So this is not small. And a $25 boat license surcharge spread over 3 years is about $8 per year. We're recommending these monies be devoted to new grants for prevention. Local leaders can pick up the slack and be leaders in preventing aquatic invasive species from getting into their lake or river. We're recommending it go into what we're calling functional containment. Let's keep these things where they are now to the best of our ability, expanding local control programs and rapid response. We Minnesota Waters, recommend that the additional monies go into these specific prevention and control categories in a timely manner and with minimal agency analysis and administration. With that, if you have questions, I'll happily answer those.
Let me start here with, I think this committee well understands the problem we have with invasives and the fact that we need a better response mechanism. I don't think I've heard any controversy at all about that. Folks are well aware and scared. It does concern me that you're putting a $25 surcharge on boats 19 feet or less. What that says to me is that boat owners who are just as good as gold, take care of their boats, don't put any, you know, make sure their boats are clean, are paying for the scofflaws who don't take care of their boats. And I raise the question of fairness there. Do you have a response?
I do have a response. I'll respond on a couple of levels. Despite the good practices of the majority of boat and trailer owners, these things, aquatic invasive species, are moving around. I don't believe personally that this is by intention at all. But the fact is, this is happening. Eric will talk about this in a minute, on Lake Minnetonka did a demonstration project last year, which showed that 7% of the boat and trailer coming into one access have Eurasian water milfoil attached to their trailer in violation of state law. So I don't believe it's intentional, but it is happening, and it's prevalent. And the enforcement of state law, which ought to stem this, is not happening either. I think there were a handful of citations statewide last year. The other aspect is some of these are invisible. Zebra mussels have been found recently by a marina operator on Lake Minnetonka to be on the interior parts of the outdrive of an engine, meaning you had to disassemble it to see these colonies grow. And so even a vigilant boat owner wouldn't have known this unless they were doing their own servicing on their engine. So this is happening. It's happening unintentionally. And these things, when they do move by boats and trailers. So I would suggest that this is fair and it's spread over all boat and trailer owners, of course. But I guess I would struggle to find a more fair alternative.
Tell us about the number of enforcements that were done on Lake Minnetonka. I know I've heard you give that number before, and I think it surprised me.
Well, the project on Lake Minnetonka was not an enforcement project per se, but it was the use through the Lake Minnetonka Conservation District in cooperation with the Minnesota DNR. The use of watercraft inspectors and automated video monitoring system that Eric will talk about in just a minute.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. You said there were only a handful of violations?
That's statewide.
Do you know the number? Would you like to share that with the members?
I can share that.
Eric will mention that.
Okay, then why don't we let him have his testimony and perhaps he'll answer that question as we go.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Eric Lindberg. I'm a resident of Plymouth, Minnesota, and I'm a volunteer with the Minnesota Waters Public Policy Committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you this morning. The aquatic invasive species are absolutely threatening our way of life in Minnesota with the lakes that we've come to know and enjoy. Eurasian water milfoil has already spread to 190 lakes in Minnesota. curlily pondweed quite a bit more. And zebra mussels are moving quite rapidly throughout our state. They're already in 235 lakes in Michigan. They're in 100 lakes in Wisconsin. And they're already boats leaving 65 Minnesota water accesses may have been exposed to zebra mussels already at this point. In a study done in Michigan, it was found that mature zebra mussels will attach themselves to weeds and are the primary vector for transportation and infestation of new water bodies. And by the weeds being hanging off trailers or boats that are leaving these launches, they will move those around. Mature mussel presence can also be seen on lower units of boats that have been in infested waters for some period of time. The DNR even found this boat lift that was going to move from Ossawinamakee McKee to another lake in the Brainerd area and caught it before the zebra mussels could be moved into a new water body. So in the heart of the Brainerd recreational area, we have zebra mussels that are threatening. Eurasian water milfoil, for those of you that haven't been exposed to it, out on Lake Minnetonka, where it originally started in 87, grows to depths of 35 feet, grows to the surface, and forms dense mats and crowds out native vegetation. You can see these images from various lakes in Minnesota. There's an impact that's significant to the fisheries, especially for aggressive fish when the zebra mussels filter out the lower end of the food chain. Or fast-growing aquatic weeds crowd out the native habitat and take away the lack of diversity. The zebra mussels that have been on lakes for some period of time die, litter the beaches, and slice open the feet of swimmers who come in. There's been numerous incidents at emergency rooms in Milwaukee where people have come in to have first aid for this. It's $55 million is being spent annually in the Great Lakes area just to clean out the infrastructure from the infestation of zebra mussels here. A less desirable consequence is the consolidation of poisons within zebra mussels and quagga mussels that move up the food chain and have killed migratory birds in Michigan this year when they ate the round gobies that had eaten the zebra mussels. There is no eradication method for zebra mussels. On the map, you can see how the zebra mussel spread has moved across Michigan, Wisconsin, and is starting to move up the rivers in Minnesota, Mississippi River. It's all the way up to Little Falls. What is unfair, I believe, is the costs that are being borne by the lake associations directly to clean their lakes where they have an option to clean their lakes of aquatic invasive species. In these seven lake associations alone, they spend over $1 million a year on AIS control treatments. There's an impact to the property values. I mean, who in their right mind would want to buy a home on a lake with invasive species versus one that was clean? That property value impact will be felt for years to come unless we stem the spread of this now. We see that the boats are not being cleaned. And the measurements taken by the DNR in Minnesota are consistent with those in Wisconsin, that 14% of the boats leaving these launches have aquatic weeds attached to them in violation of the law. In Minnesota, in the study in 2005, 198 of the visiting boats that the interns identified were coming from zebra mussel infested waters. But the challenge is that even spending $35,000 a year for DNR intern monitoring, Lake Minnetonka can't close their risk. It can only address 6% of the monitoring need for the boats coming in. My company did a study for Lake Minnetonka last year where we saw that 7.8% of the boats coming into Lake Minnetonka had weeds attached and were launching boats. After we educated users of these facilities that there was monitoring taking place in compliance with the law, we saw that drop down to 1.4%. But these levels are consistent with what they're seeing in Wisconsin, with around 8% of the boats launching into these lakes with weeds attached to their trailer. Here's some excerpts of video captures where we have weeds that we see off the trailer and the identification of the vehicles. They range from fishermen to pleasure craft people, and I don't believe these are people that are necessarily aware that they're bringing aquatics into these lakes. They just, it's hard to get underneath a boat and take care of this. And there's not enough emphasis being placed on this. In Wisconsin, we mapped the infested waters and see since 1996, they've spread from the southeastern part of the state all the way up to the northern part of the state, and the infestation vector is along roadways. We can see that the lakes that are newly infested are easily accessible by the road. In Minnesota, we can see that around the metro area, we have a high concentration of lakes with Eurasian water milfoil infestations, and it's spreading to other counties across Minnesota. Sorry, that map isn't towards the front, but it shows that in the metro area, there is a very high percentage of lakes already here that are infested with Eurasian water milfoil. And in Hubbard County, behind the Minnesota map, there's only one lake, Leech Lake, that has Eurasian water milfoil infestation. So the opportunity to stop the spread of it is still within our grasp. The enforcement is a challenge. You asked about how many citations were issued. In 2005, there were 5 citations issued in the entire state for violations of carrying aquatic plants on trailers or launching them into a lake. It went up in 2006 to 18 citations, but clearly there needs to be greater enforcement for this to be a priority for the visitors to the lakes in Minnesota. In Wisconsin, we might have beaten them recently in hockey, but I think they're ahead of us when it comes to AIS cost share grants. Mm-hmm. I mean, they provide $1.5 million annually to lake associations to provide local cost sharing for inspections at the boat launches, early detection, rapid response, and control mechanisms. They have some good results with the volunteer hours inspecting 70,000 boats over 6 years, but still, there's a lot of boats coming from AIS-infested waters. These notes are in your packet, but in summary, we're way behind in fighting AIS through prevention and control compared to Wisconsin and the need that we have. And if we don't put additional effort towards this, the spread is going to escalate based on what we've seen in Wisconsin and other states and what we're seeing in the boat launches at trampoline lakes like Lake Minnetonka, which was originally infested with Eurasian water milfoil, and now we're up to 190-plus lakes with Eurasian water milfoil, and the same will happen with zebra mussels as well. And we need to match the efforts of local lake associations and constituencies to take responsibility for preventing AIS and give the DNR more tools that they need to fight this battle before it's too late.
And now we'll hear from Terry Christian.
Just before that, Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, we've heard a number of presentations on aquatic invasives, and it's kind of numbing in terms of the consequences and where we're at. And I keep thinking about if this was a public health issue, there'd be a different response in terms of triaging or trying to deal with this. And I'm worried about the next zebra mussel or the next milfoil, and it seems that we need to prevent that from occurring. And I'm worried that the next one is the VHS virus, and we have the shipping open on the Lake Superior in a few days. And for the last few months, we've been trying to work with the agencies on seeing if we can deal with ballast water under existing law. I just, you know, here we're raising fees on boats to deal with something that's here. How do we, shouldn't we be dealing with trying to prevent something from getting here?
Madam Chair, could you say that, shouldn't we be, I didn't hear that last little piece, you said shouldn't we be
trying to prevent something from getting here?
Put that question on the table. Would you like to answer it, Mr. Lindbergh?
Yeah, well, one option, I mean, we see a lot of boats that are coming to Minnesota for its recreational and tourism value coming from places like Indiana, where they originally or recently discovered hydrilla, which Dick can describe as the perfect weed, and there's nothing at the borders to do inspection of these boaters as they trailer up here and enjoy our lakes. So there's a number of vectors that can bring the aquatic invasive species into the state. Dick, maybe you want to...
Madam Chair, may I? I would agree that the question, should we or shouldn't we, depending on how you ask it, yes, we should be doing more to prevent it. Part of our recommendation and in the bill provides for some level of extra protection. It arguably will never be enough. The main focus of where this would be applied in Minnesota, as we propose it in this bill, would be on infra and interstate transport of these things. And the Great Lakes are a notable gap in that. That's a huge problem, subject to state, national, and international laws and treaties and those kinds of things, and should not be overlooked. That said, Eurasian water milfoil didn't come from the Great Lakes. Hydrilla, which is working its way here, and is so competitive that it's been known to crowd out the Eurasian water milfoil, which is aggressive, is a huge concern. The other way to look at that is, unlike states like Wisconsin or Michigan, which have significant inland borders along Lake Michigan in this case, the state of Minnesota has a relatively small inland border with respect to the Duluth Superior Harbor. In other words, not many boats cross to and from the Great Lakes to inland lakes in Minnesota, unlike those other two states. So the spread of things like zebra mussels, which are in the Duluth Superior Harbor, probably is more significant from inter and intrastate spread as opposed to from the Great Lakes directly. Although that's where most of these things are coming into the country initially.
Representative Dill, there, I think we read in the paper there's some new critters in some of the lakes up in your district, and there may be one or two lakes right now. You know, wouldn't it be better to try to deal with some of where there's one or two infestations and try to prevent it? Or you may know more about this, and I just wanted to give you the opportunity.
We'd like to get rid of them as quick as we possibly can. They're going to be, you know, a major problem. I think the spiny water flea now is in the national park, which is water that goes, you know, travels the entire border from Pigeon River all the way into Canada, into the Hudson Bay. And I just assume that will continue to increase in its propensity and be more and more problematic, mm-hmm. among other things. So...
All right, if you would want to continue with your testimony.
My name is Terry Christian. I serve on the Minnesota Waters Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force. I grew up on Leech Lake and currently live on Medicine Lake in the city of Plymouth in the metro area, and I am the president of the Lake Association. I've seen firsthand the devastation that aquatic invasives can deliver to lakes. Curlew pondweed, which is actually a water quality issue. There's a picture on this handout, this four-page colored handout that I've given all of you. That picture was taken by me at our shoreline, and that is an algal bloom that happened after the dieback of curlew pondweed. What happens with curlew is that it has massive amounts of biomass, and when it dies, it releases phosphorus into the water column, and then as it decays, it falls to the bottom of the lake, and it uses up the available oxygen at the bottom of the lake, and then because it's an anoxic condition, then more phosphorus can be released from the sediment. So you have both soluble and insoluble phosphorus being allowed to go into the water column that causes these terrible, terrible algae blooms. And not only can you not really swim or use this water, they found that blue-green algae is actually toxic. Dogs have died from it, etc. Some some talk has happened here about other aquatic invasives. Rusty crayfish has been now found to be in Leech Lake. And a recent DNR survey of rusty crayfish in Leech Lake found 46 crayfish per square meter of lake bottom. Both zebra mussels and rusty crayfish affect walleye fisheries. The damage is ecological, economical, and social. In the last 3 years, more than $300,000 has been spent to treat curly-leaf pondweed in Medicine Lake. Since treatments have begun, we have not seen another algal bloom of this magnitude. Treatment works. It is also very expensive. Just think, this is one species, one 1,000-acre lake, and look at the cost. We did get a grant from the DNR last year in the amount of $20,000. A few weeks ago, I attended a hearing in the Senate Finance Committee, and I heard Senator Bach address the committee. He started out by agreeing that aquatic invasive species is an important issue for the state of Minnesota and deserves to be addressed. He talked about honesty in government and that we should raise money to pay for what is needed to address the AIS. He described many homeowners that in Minnesota that they put their boat in the lake in the spring, they live on the lake, they take it out in the fall, and they're not the people that are passing around the aquatic invasive species. I've lived on Medicine Lake for 23 years, and I'm one of those. And Senator Bach was concerned that those of us that live on the lake would be paying this fee, and we're not the ones that are spreading the aquatic invasives around. But I am for the fee, very much for the fee. The first year of treatment in Medicine Lake was paid for by Plymouth Surface Water Management fee. That is paid for by every citizen in Plymouth, and many of those don't even use the lake or even have boats. The last 2 years were paid for by Bassett Creek Watershed Management Organization. Bassett Creek Water Management Organization recently completed their second generation planning process, which gives them a water quality focus rather than a water quantity focus. When they did this, they got Hennepin County to pass an ad valorem tax to have monies available for water quality work. Because curly-leaf pondweed causes the algal bloom, it qualified for this money because it is a water quality issue. I see this as an example of taxing all the citizens to pay for spread of aquatic invasive species. There are boaters that use the lake but do not live in our watershed, and they're not paying anything for this. This is one of the reasons why we need a statewide program to pay for all of this cost. Another mechanism being used in the state to collect funds from property owners on the lakes is a Lake Improvement District, or a LID. There are about 20 of these in the state, and more are being considered. An example is Lake Alexander in Morrison County, which collects $131 per resident from each shoreland owner. Nothing is collected from the visitors launching their boats into the lake. It is not all of the citizens who are spreading the AIS, but it is the boaters. There are actually maps, as you've seen, that Eric showed, where the infested lakes are near the roads. It's not all of the boaters, but it is really the boaters that are the vectors. It is also a concern that we have a tax versus a fee for the long-term funding. A general fund source of funding is short-term and unpredictable. A fee is ongoing and fair assessment shared by all citizens who use the lake. What has been happening is that the local citizens have been carrying the full burden of controlling the invasives once a lake is infested. A fee would spread that load to all boaters. We need dedicated funding in the state long-term to address not only the aquatic invasives that are here, but more that are coming. We need to fund this threat at a level that makes sense for the real needs of the lakes in the state. The lake scientists who have been helping us with curly-leaf pondweed treatment tell us because of the probable existence of seedbed that we can expect to need ongoing maintenance treatment. The Plymouth Surface Water Management fee has budgeted $15,000 for 2007. This is a crisis. You can help us. Thank you.
Thank you all for your testimony. We appreciate it very much. Thank you. Yes, Representative Bill.
Okay, well, I just want to add that it's interesting the Senator Bach said that. That happens to be my senator. Just thinking about my little community where I live. That's pretty small. There are four marinas in our community. They have, the Hanford Marine probably has about 500 boats that they keep over the course of the winter and summer. Most people don't even have roadworthy trailers. I mean, all they use their trailer for is to get it out of the lake into the storage garage and then back to the lake when they arrive in the summer. And then you multiply that times many, many, many facilities that are in my legislative district. I think you'd be talking about thousands upon thousands of boats that have same kind of a situation. So I think that I hadn't thought of that. That's an interesting problem to address. I have three. My boats have never left town. I mean, they've never been out of the lake.
I think we have run out of time on this issue. We have three other issues before us, four, and we have to take care of them today. Thank you very much for coming. Representative Junkie,
thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add that there was a possible amendment if we were going to put this onto the bill, and I'm not sure how you wanted to
do that because this is an informational hearing at this
okay.
point.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
All right. Representative Junkie, I will move House File 593 to lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Madam Chair, I think you do have an amendment.
You do have an amendment. Okay. Oh, it's coming around.
The amendment you're getting, members, we had the hearing over in policy and some suggestions were made there, and so this is an author's amendment which takes those suggestions to heart. If you would put it on, then I can explain the bill.
I will move amendment A2. Are there questions on the amendment before members vote? I don't see any questions. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted.
And Madam Chair, members, what this is again, to repeat the story for those that weren't on policy, we've got a situation out there where there's federal dollars available to do wetland restorations, which we all want to do for our habitat, for our duck hunters, for all the other things that we know are benefits of that. Unfortunately, what we're finding is a lot of landowners, farmers in particular, when these new wetlands, newly created or restored wetlands, adjoin a public right-of-way, be it a road, a state park, a county park, whatever it is, they quickly start to learn that 5 or 10 acre restoration becomes public waters, and folks now can use those public waters. So the first duck hunting season comes, and Farmer John has a hunter that shows up back behind his barn on the newly restored right-of-way shooting ducks at an early hour in the morning, and he's not happy. And he tells his neighbors that, and consequently we're seeing some resistance to restoring wetlands, particularly when they're abutting right-of-way. So basically what this bill says is if a created, brand new, or restored, nothing there now, wetland, is developed, the farmer may designate that to be non-public by posting, the regular posting laws. So they have the opportunity to do that on those wetlands, again, that are brand newly created or restored. That's the only case it pertains to. It doesn't pertain to things that don't abut right-of-ways. It does not pertain to existing wetlands. It does not pertain to expansion of existing wetlands. It's only for those, literally, where we're maybe blocking up a tile and recreating a wetland in a farmer's field so we can keep the public off if that's their goal. So we hope to utilize more money with this and be able to actually restore more wetlands. That's the bill.
Thank you, Representative Junkie. Are there any questions? I don't see any questions. Oh, I do see a question. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Junkie, I'm wondering if you could read Subdivision 2 with your amendment, because it seems like there's a word missing or something in the last phrase, or because you changed the as to if. I'm wondering you can just read it through it.
Representative Pinkel said maybe we could have the author of the amendment that authored it for me do it, the research folks over here. Does it match up, John?
Counsel?
He brought this down to me yesterday and said this, it does it, and I apologize. I didn't exactly cross it out and fit it in.
Members, we may not need the last exception now because we're saying if posted by the landowner, we could put a period there if that's what you're concerned about, Representative Tinglestead.
I think that clarifies it. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to read the whole sentence with all the phrases in. Yeah. Thank you.
So if it is posted by the landowner, there's no public access.
Right. So we could, Representative Tinglestead and Madam Chair, if you wanted to, you could, on line 113, replace the comma with a period and delete the rest of that line.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Tinglestead moves it on line 13 to strike the comma, add a period, and strike the rest of that sentence. Everybody understand? I don't see any questions. All those in favor of adopting that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? That amendment is adopted. Do I see questions now? I do not. Representative Junkie, we will lay this over for possible inclusion in the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I appreciate your consideration.
Next, we have three more things. Representative Hansen is not here. So, Representative Moe, you have some shoreline file, 849.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we do have this bill, Madam Chair. So
we do have this bill.
Do we actually get an act on something here?
For possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you want to move the bill?
Yeah, I'd like to move. I thought I heard you say that, but I'd like to move House File 849 for possible inclusion in the omnibus Environment and Natural Resource Finance Bill. But most members have heard this already, so I'll be brief, and then I'll bring up Joel Carlson to talk about a few other things. Background, small resorts in Minnesota have been in trouble for a while for a variety of reasons, but most people know that these are very important to our northern Minnesota economies, one, and two, small resorts as an impact on the environment, on shoreland, and on water quality, it is far less than the resulting development if those resorts are sold and subdivided into planned unit developments. So as far as this bill goes, we're supporting northern Minnesota or primarily rural resort economies, one, and two, protecting the environment by doing all that we can to keep those resorts functioning profitably. There are three specific components of this bill. I'm waiting for Mr. Carlson to come up. Come on up. One allows resorts to maintain, repair, and rebuild structures that are currently become non-conforming if zoning changes have occurred since the buildings originally built, as long as those buildings don't encroach towards the shoreline, they either they could build away from the shoreline. They can't expand laterally either. It also has some other zoning changes that would decrease the likelihood that those resorts would be sold and become planned unit developments. With that, I see Mr. Carlson's here, and I'll have him introduce himself and give you more details.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson.
I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, which is an organization of small, family-owned resort businesses in Minnesota. At one time, Minnesota had about 3,600 small resorts. We're down to about 900 now, and it declines every year. House File 849 is an effort to get at a problem that resorts have when they lose their property through natural disaster, when they or fire, when they need to rebuild or maintain their facilities, or when they look at alternative forms of ownership. I have, on behalf of the Congress, have worked with a number of interested parties to get the bill in front of you in a form that I believe does not have opposition. We've worked with local units of government, the DNR, and others to bring to you a bill that allows for a consistent zoning mechanism across the state so that when resorts need to build and maintain their facilities, they will be able to do that consistently across across the state. A couple of the provisions that were amended after this bill was heard in the in Senator, or excuse me, Representative Eakin's Environment Committee on lines on page 1, line 14, it was unclear if this would apply to existing resorts or to new or expanded resorts, and we added a provision that indicates on line 14 that the resort must be in existence before the effective date of this act. So this would not apply to a new resort or a new development that would come online. We also, at the request of Representative Dill, we made a correction page 1, line 22, that makes it clear that these resorts would not allow for any residential use. These are not intended to be residences for anybody beyond the owners of the resort. Madam Chair and members, we also added, at the suggestion of Representative Osmond, a provision on page 2, line 9, on page 2, line 15, that indicates that that the structure, as it may be expanded to minimally meet a code, cannot result in the structure being any larger than what is only necessary to meet that code requirement. The resort would not be allowed to add any amenities or new features to an existing unit. It would only be that minimal amount needed to meet a code requirement. Madam Chairman and members, the final provision of the bill gets at an issue of resort ownership. A number of resorts are looking at alternative forms of ownership so that they can keep the access available to the public, even though it may not be only owned by a single family ownership any longer. And this just says that as long as you're continuing to operate as a resort, your ownership doesn't change the use of the resort. Those are the three provisions, Madam Chairman, of the bill, and we would appreciate the committee's support, and happy to answer any questions that you might have or discuss other issues that the committee may have before them. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members.
Questions from the committee?
I don't see any questions. I understand there is an amendment coming. Okay. It's getting copied, so if you would like to, the mover of the amendment would like to talk about it, because I don't see any questions on the underlying bill at this point.
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, we had heard this in policy, and it's made its way through some steps, and it seems that the issue began as a pilot project, and there's some desire to have this go to a statewide possibility. Could you maybe elaborate on that?
Do you mean, Representative, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, do you mean this particular bill started as a pilot project, or the shoreland ordinances more broadly?
Shoreland ordinance.
Yeah, okay. This process began, and I don't know the dates, but I do know that there was a stakeholder process that came together in the five-county area surrounding where I live, Cass, Itasca, Clearwater, surrounding counties, five. I could recite them all, crowing. That took a little bit of time. Essentially looking at issues of shoreland and shoreland development, how we can, as people continue to develop our last remaining shoreland, how can we do so in a way that that protects the environment and also allows for some growth, you know, that's essential to support our economies in greater Minnesota, where this shoreland's mostly, buildable shorelands mostly exist. Part of that, part of those recommendations came out of that process. This specific bill are portion of those recommendations that pertain specifically to resorts. And even though it's not completely typical, but because of the pressing need, and these recommendations have been kind of adopted piecemeal by several counties anyway. I mean, I think many of us would like them to be adopted more rigorously, but this is an attempt to put into statute some of those recommendations. I think in that five-county area, there's a pretty aggressive effort to implement the majority of those recommendations, but no county or entity has adopted all of them yet.
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, the amendment that I think is going to be coming out relates to rulemaking, and I was asked by the author to present this. This would have a fiscal impact, but I think it also, if we adopt this amendment, would need to go back to the policy committee because it has some, I see Representative Eakin is nodding his head vigorously. So I think you should be receiving House or H0849A1 right now. And I would move the amendment.
Amendment A1 has been moved. Is there discussion to this amendment? Council?
Madam Chair and members, I just noticed it should be after line 20 on page 2.
Line 20 on page 2. It's on line 1.2.
Madam Chair, Representative Osmond, you know, you had asked what it does, and I should have a copy there now. What this would do is direct the Commissioner of DNR to begin rulemaking on the alternative shoreline management standards to Minnesota rules as drafted and published by the DNR on December 12, 2005. So it's, and again, there would be a cost on this. It's directing the DNR to start the rulemaking process.
Madam Chair, I think the members of the committee know that most members know that I support this process. Under some conditions would accept it as a friendly amendment. I guess I would maybe, the Chair, would you like to, I mean, this is broadening the bill significantly. Would you like to take testimony here about this, or should we refer this?
Well,
if this bill goes on, if this amendment goes on?
If this amendment goes on, we will refer it back to policy. So that will, that is, members can assume that will happen. If you would like to have testimony on this amendment, this would be an appropriate time to do it.
Madam Chair, before I leave the table, can I offer my thoughts? This is the first I've seen it. I've watched the telephone around the room, so I knew something was was in the works. But Madam Chairman and members, the Congress was contacted by the Center for Environmental Advocacy in October and November, asking for our support to force the DNR into the rulemaking process, and we declined to do that at that time because we actively participated in the alternative standards development and knew kind of what that process was at the time. And I, as I indicated and would indicate to the committee again, you know, we did in good faith work with local units of government and the DNR to get the bill to the form that it is before you now. And the Godfather said, you know, you have friends or you've got no friends. And we have told our friends that we really wouldn't use this bill as a vehicle to force the DNR into rulemaking. And so it's certainly the committee's desire as to what you do with the bill, but wanted the committee to know that we've indicated on behalf of the small resorts that we didn't really want this to be the vehicle for this process to move forward. So with that, Madam Chairman, I appreciate the committee's time, and whatever route the bill takes, we will follow it along. And I did indicate to Representative Moe that that was our desire when we started the process as well. So thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Moe, and then Representative Packard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I want to be clear here from my perspective as the author. I support the bill as it stands. It's an important bill for our resorts. I think the amendment before us, should it go on, we would need to go to policy, and maybe the policy chair could see if there's actually time to make for this hearing so we can meet deadline. And then following that, I'm guessing there's going to be a cost to this, so it should come back to our committee, and we should decide if we have the resources to do whatever that cost is to be determined. So I just to put it clearly on the table what the route would be as we proceed.
That is my understanding of what the process would be, and Representative Eakin is nodding his head that we would have time for a hearing.
And Madam Chair, Representative Moe, I believe as long as it's for consideration in the omnibus bill as well, we would have next week as well to if we needed to have a full hearing on this, we could do that on Tuesday. I think that would be possible.
We will discuss the times, and we will make sure that there is time to get it done. How's that? I think that we would need to do some logistics here, but we will discuss that.
And then,
Madam Chair, if there is some time,
okay. Then, Madam Chair, then one follow-up: should we not support this amendment, or have concerns about the fiscal impact in the future? I would like the committee to consider the bill on its own without the amendment as it comes back, when it comes back to this committee, so we can move that portion. Thank you.
I think the process is understood by all.
Thank you.
Representative Hackbarth, do you have a question?
Well, a comment, Madam Chair. I think it's more than just send it back to the policy committee. This is an issue that's going to have to go to government operations. The rulemaking issue has to go through government operations. That's plain and simple. I mean, and essentially what this amendment would do is either slow down the process so much or essentially kill the bill for this year if this has to go through policy and through government operations and back to what this amendment does, Madam Chair, is being introduced this late to this bill kills this bill. I support the issue for the resort owners and we need to move forward on that, but adopting this amendment kills the bill.
Well, we're not sure of that, Representative Hackbarth.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know that government operations is going to be meeting again.
We'll have to have those discussions. I can't answer that question one way or the other. Representative Tinglesith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, that was my point, too. I think GovOps, their last meeting is Thursday this week.
All right. Thank you. I think we understand the process issues. Now we will talk about the subject issues.
Okay.
And if you would like, if there are testifiers for and against the amendment, it's time to have those.
I'm guessing by who's in the room, that could take some time. Do we want to limit that?
We have to limit it because we have two other bills up for informational hearings. I don't think either of those have... they haven't arrived, but they are informational hearings, and I don't think either one of them have particularly large questions looming over them.
in addition to what members have in front of them on those, is not the committee on girls' rights. So,
okay. In that case, we have 15 minutes, and so we have limits each side to 5 minutes.
Okay, so let's see. Do we want to? I'm guessing this group lined up here is the opposition. Do you want to come forward in a couple minutes each, maybe?
Hi, Kent Lockett, Mullen, Director of the Division of Waters. Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment, as you know, would direct the DNR to do rulemaking. This is a real change in what we went through with the alternative standard process. It was developed as a voluntary process for the five pilot counties in north central Minnesota. So to switch now to go directly to rulemaking with this is a real change in the policy. I think it's appropriate to have that policy discussion. The time frame in this is, I think, unrealistic to be completed, to have an end date in a rule process, because that's an open process. How an administrative law judge actually deals with this process is yet to be determined. And there's a significant, we will be preparing a fiscal note for this this committee's consideration. I would estimate the cost in the neighborhood of $1 million.
Representative, back now.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lockershmal, I can appreciate your concern that it will cost $1 million. The reality is that's one lake lot on some of these lakes nowadays. I don't know what we're going to do, but we got to do something, and we got to do it quick. Maybe this timeline is unrealistic, and Representative Hackbart and Representative Tingelstedt have said that, you know, we can't even get this thing moving. All I can say is we have to do something, and we have to do it quick. And there's so many folks out there and so many different rules around all this stuff that we have to react. And if it means that the time frame is unrealistic, that's probably what we need to get to. We need to get to a time frame that pushes us to the limit of what is realistic, I guess. And it's just my hope. If it takes a bunch of money, we need to put money in it. And I'm not so sure. The way these folks are spending money in developing these lakes, we've got to react. I mean, to see what I've seen in 30 years that I've been one of these lakeshore owners is troubling, to say the least. And I'm already in, so I'm safe. All the ones that aren't in is who I'd want to protect. You know, it's that, what do you call it? I had one where you say, not in my own backyard type of deal. But I mean that facetiously. We have to protect what we have left. And I know this is controversial with the counties and that, but we just really, I'm sorry, but if you're saying we're pushing to the limit, I think we have to push to the limit on this issue and change a lot of people's thought process here. And I guess, don't you feel that? Don't you feel that, I mean, you got to have your people on the ground looking and saying, what are we going to do? Where are we going to stop? I mean, we're taking all the bulrushes down. We're doing everything. I just think we're going the wrong direction too quick.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, what we're doing now is actively marketing these alternative standards. There's meetings throughout those counties and throughout the state with zoning officials and county officials, municipal officials. So they're informed of the value of those, and we've seen a number of counties taking them under consideration and adopting the appropriate parts. To switch and change now and make them... Had we initiated this five-county pilot with a mandatory statewide, or had a mandatory statewide process, the end result would have been different. We're going to have to now have a stakeholder group and develop a rule based on some mandatory standards, and that's fine. Should we be moving forward with rules? We are having discussions with the counties. It is something, you're right, if this is an important route to go for the legislature, it needs to be adequately funded, and we can move forward.
Thank you. Let's be very, very quick. Just have your opinion. And
good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will be very brief. As you've heard me testify before, counties have significant...
If you could give your name.
Annalie Garlitz, Association of Minnesota Counties. As I've testified before, counties have significant concerns with going forward with the alternative standards. There were five counties that were involved in this pilot project, and there were county commissioners, county planning and zoning staff that were involved. And I've heard from all of them that if they would have known that this was to go forward on a statewide basis, as Mr. Lockesbrough said, the outcome would have been quite different. We are in conversations right now with the Department of Natural Resources about going forward with the rulemaking, but we believe that this needs to be done on a much broader basis. We need to involve all the different stakeholders and commissioners and planning and zoning staff from around the state to be involved and have some comments into this process. We look forward to working with people in the future. Right now, as Mr. Loxton also said, there's education that's going on. But moving forward with just the alternative shoreland standards is something that's a large concern because it was only developed for five counties.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. One of our board members was very actively involved with the development of the alternative standards, served on the work group from its inception until the completion of the rules, and did so because he was personally very interested in making sure that we do preserve the waters of the state and concerned about the development, but also understanding the other side of some of the issues as a local government officer. And part of what got the buy-in for the alternative rules in his area, which is up in Cass County, was the fact that there was repeated assurances it was not going to be ramrodded down anybody's throat, it wasn't going to be forced on anybody as a statewide standard, and that it could be used as an educational process to, as Representative McNamara alluded to, start changing the thought process and actually get people to look at things in a different light. But you do that by education, you do that by allowing things to work, and you do that by honoring commitments. And by backdooring something now as a statewide approach, I can tell you that a number of the local officials that were part of this process are going to feel quite burned by the process, and they're going to become very skeptical about what's really going on, and it's going to be much harder to get support for any new rules. It's going to get very harder to get support for implementation, and so I would encourage you to think seriously about the unintended consequences of putting this type of amendment on. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we need to have folks from the other side now.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. My name is Henry Van Ocklin. I work for Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I'm the natural resource scientist for them. I worked for DNR for a dozen years before that. I was a member of the 34-member stakeholder group, which had very diverse interests, including statewide interests, such as ourselves. There were a number of builders groups there. There was the Minnesota Waters or Minnesota Lakes Association at the time. And it was a very diverse group of stakeholders. And I think what we're talking about here is not forcing anything down anyone's throat. It is a continuation of the process. We had a pilot project, and that pilot project has only resulted in after a year, a little bit of advancement of a few different pieces of those rules. And I think we had an informational hearing on shorelands a few weeks ago in Representative Eakin's committee, and you know it's clear that Minnesota shorelands are at risk, and I think you folks have probably seen that. We're being, most of the quality lakeshore has been developed. Development pressures have now turned to marginal lakeshore. Small seasonal cabins are being turned into large year-round homes. High-density development is very much in favor, and the current rules, which were originally drafted in 1971. And were revised in 1989, are not adequate any longer. It's been 16 years. The pressure, I think, is illustrated by something going on in my county recently. Someone was trying, and you may have read this, it ended up in the Star Tribune from the local Becker County paper, someone was trying to turn a lake name, which was Bullhead Lake, into Bluebird Lake. That is the pressure we're seeing out there in our lakes. They are, you know, especially on marginal lakes, which really cannot handle the pressure. And they're putting our resources at risk. There's lots of discussion of water quality. This change or revision of shoreline standards fits perfectly into the whole effort to improve the water quality of Minnesota's waters. And the rules, going through a rulemaking process will level the playing field across the state, just as was done in 1989. This is nothing new for the counties or other local governments. We're talking about going through a rulemaking process. And that's all that this amendment does, is wanting to go through a rulemaking process, which is an open and public process. You know, I was part of the five-county process, and yes, we agreed that DNR said they would be voluntary. I feel sort of burned by the counties and other local governments, which have not, in the last 15 months, actively pursued adopting all but a very few pieces of the alternative standards. So there's definitely two sides to this. We are talking about going through an open rulemaking process. We always start with some sort of rules. And I'll let Jeanette talk about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeanette Brimmer. I'm the legal director with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and have assisted Henry as we've moved through this process. I just want to take a few moments to sort of really clarify what we're talking about here, because I think there is a lot of emotion, a lot of history tied up in this. First of all, this legislature a long time ago said to DNR, you have the obligation to protect our shorelands, and you're supposed to do that through enacting minimum standards, and that's exactly what DNR has done on a couple of occasions previously, as Henry said, most recently in 1989. Out of this advisory process that we are all talking about, this stakeholder process that, again, had broad representation on that, even though it was concentrating on the five-county area, out of that came some extensive findings by DNR itself. In other words, the process was working. DNR's findings are a rationale and assessment for these new standards being a revision to their existing minimum standards. You can see that rationale on their website, and I'm going to give you a few of their findings from that so you can see that those findings were statewide. They recognized a statewide problem, and they talked about the need and the fact that the existing standards aren't adequate. DNR found in that rationale development pressure is increasing at a rate, an average rate of 4,000 homes a year. And let me remind you that we have had this process going on since 2004 already. In other words, we're into year three of this process right now. When DNR first called for comments on revisions to their rules in 2004. The DNR finds that what has been happening with this increased development pressure is public perception is that our lakes are deteriorating, that our shoreline is deteriorating. And DNR specifically states, the science bears that out. Limnology bears that out, that is in fact happening. DNR's own rationale, which has 6 pages of scientific citations attached to it, the degradation of Minnesota's shallow lakes has been broad-based, cumulative, and persistent, with the majority of lakes in central or southwest Minnesota, again making findings outside the five counties, non-supporting of aquatic recreational uses. And that has occurred under the existing rule regime. DNR concludes higher protection standards such as those set forth in these alternative standards for natural environment special protection lakes can preserve our significant shoreland resources, including what's important to ducks. Also, the rationale finds, over time, removal and alteration of trees, shrubs, natural vegetation in the shoreland impact zone from development has destroyed or degraded habitat along most of Minnesota's lakes, with increasing implications to wildlife populations. DNR cites that as a reason to have buffer requirements, vegetative buffer requirements when we are talking about development. All of these are things not in the current rules. The rulemaking process would be open and would be public. That's how it works. DNR would publish a proposed rule. Let's use the ALT standards that they've already spent a lot of quality time on, that they have spent over a year developing.
Those go out on public notice. We can have additional stakeholder groups. We agree we should pull in municipalities that were not particularly present at that advisory committee. From that point, it goes to hearings that are statewide and administrative law judges involved. So there's obviously ample time. So we would advocate that we move into that process, give DNR the chance to do that rulemaking. There will be a fiscal impact. I doubt it is $500,000 since we've already gone halfway through that process, and we've spent some good time. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks, and we can take questions.
Okay. We have very little time for questions. I see two. Representative Anzels was first.
Madam Chair and members, and with all due respect to the author of the amendment, I represent one of the pilot counties, and I'm a former county commissioner. And this is the wrong amendment at the wrong time and the wrong place. This is a subject, a topic that needs to be vetted in another way. I would hate to lose the thrust of the original intent of Representative Moe's legislation regarding small resorts, which I have many of, which we need the relief here. And lastly, it's been my experience that we get more when we work in partnership with local units of government rather than in a top-down approach and mandating things and making requirements without understanding local pressures and local issues. So with all due respect, Representative Hansen, I'd urge the committee to vote no on the amendment.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just this is all about time. I am curious of whether this rulemaking process can, I mean, rulemaking is very time consuming. I don't know if we can do it under this timeline, but I guess I'd like to ask anybody if they can say whether by going into alternative or rulemaking about alternative standards, are we going to start adopting a cookie-cutter approach, or are we going to start adopting region-by-region stuff? I just want to cut right to the chase. I think we all recognize what we're trying to do, but I just, where everybody's in crunch time here, and I don't think we want to rush into something that we don't understand. Thank you.
I think rulemaking is so open, you could do either. I mean, that is part of rulemaking. Are there other questions? I am worried about the time here. And I think we are ready to vote on Representative Hansen's motion to amend A1 onto House File 849. Representative Barton.
Madam Chair, this is going to be devastating, this bill. I think we need to move forward on this bill. I think it's a mistake to put the amendment on. I think this is not a win-win situation for this bill. It's a lose-lose. It kills the bill. I would ask for a roll call vote.
A roll call has been requested.
Madam Chair,
the last word.
Madam Chair, you are certainly entitled
to the last word.
Thank you. I do support the amendment, but I do think we need to have further discussion. So going to policy makes sense. I said I would say this. The League of Minnesota Cities is opposed to this and has concerns. They were part of the stakeholder process too. So I won't read all your comments, but just so that's on the record. So I guess we go to the vote.
With that, we will begin the roll of call, and of course we'll take the roll.
Anzels?
No.
Clark? Doe? Doty?
Yes.
Ethan?
No.
Gardner?
No.
Sumter?
No.
Hackbarth?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Poppy?
No.
Knuth?
Yes.
Magnus?
No.
McNamara?
No.
Moe?
Yes.
Osmond?
No.
Peterson? Scalzi?
No.
Tinglestad?
No.
Wagenius?
Yes.
There are 5 ayes and 11 nays.
5 ayes and 11 nays. The amendment is not adopted. Members, one of the things that I felt a lot of passion in a couple of issues that have come up lately, and that's what always happens for the end of our hearing times. And because of that, and because we are at a crunch time for time, we will have hearings in the fall on at least 2 issues, and one of them will be invasive species and how we respond to it. And we will take some quality time to hear from lots of folks. And the second will be on this issue. And at that time, we can hear how far DNR and the counties and the cities have progressed with adopting rules that on a voluntary basis. So we will have, we'll probably do this in October. So they will have ample time to give us a good report about what's happening. And with that, I'm going to lay over House File 849, if that is still the will of the author.
Madam Chair, do you feel that there's a fiscal impact to this? I know you wanted to see it. Do you feel like speaking to that, or are you intent on having this be part of the potentially be part of the omnibus bill?
If you would like to send it on without, I do not see a fiscal impact on the bill as it is right now. I have, and if I am wrong about that, I'm sure people are going to tell me right away. But would you like to just send it on without rolling it into the omnibus bill? It's your call.
Yeah, I would like to move this, change my motion to this bill to pass and to be sent to the General Register.
Okay. The motion has been amended that House File 849 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Oh, it says we'll actually have to return to finance first, but okay. We will recommend that it pass
to refer to finance,
and then recommend to go to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we have to vote on that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? That motion is adopted. Members, I also just would announce to you we're not going to be representing Kansas bills because we don't have any gross copies before us, and we would at least need that to have an informational hearing. There is a hearing tomorrow at 10 o'clock in room 10 with Tyrone Hayes, who is a world-known endocrine disruptor scientist. He will be talking about endocrine disruptors, breast cancer, and atrazine. It should be lively. So I just wanted to let members know, because it will not only be lively, he is an outstanding speaker, and I think he would enjoy it. With that, meeting is adjourned.